Dr. Oliver Speck recently spoke at the Goethe Institute in Washington, D.C. about Austrian film director Michael Haneke and his latest work, The White Ribbon. The film has received near universal critical praise. It's picked up a Golden Globe Award, and it was nominated for an Oscar for Best Foreign Film. Oliver Speck is Assistant Professor of German and Film Studies at Virginia Commonwealth University. His book, Funny Frames, The Filmic Concepts of Michael Haneke, is due out June 1st.
I would like to thank the Goethe Institute, Washington, D.C., of course, for giving me the opportunity to share some of my thoughts on Michael Haneke's Das Weiße Band, The White Ribbon, with you. My talk is only partially based on my book, Funny Frames, The Filmic Concepts of Michael Haneke. It's forthcoming with Continuum, so I don't bring you a copy here. It's forthcoming on June 1st. And I said partially because, of course, I still want you to read my book, and because the bulk of it was written before The White Ribbon was released last year. I will, however, use a concept from my book, and that's the frame, and provide you today with three articulations of the frame in order to point out what makes this film so exceptional. It's a really exceptional film. One of my students saw it, and if you remember, it's a student, I think he's 19 or 20, he came out of the film and said, "I am responsible for 9/11, right? And I think it was really a Haneke insight this young student had, because remember, he was about, you know, 9 or 10 years old at that time. And this, I think, is very much a Haneke moment. It's why I really admire this filmmaker. He gives you great insights, and I think this is why the metaphor of the frame works really well. It's all about the framing. So, first frame concerns the viewer, who has to put a lot of work into a Haneke film. The second frame will be about the place this film, The White Ribbon, has in Haneke's oeuvre. And the third and final frame concerns politics and power. And these three frames are not separate and should be thought of as interlocking, overlapping, feeding into each other. Let me begin with the very basic notion of the exceptional. Since I said before, he's an exceptional filmmaker. To be able to appreciate the exceptional, we need to look at things from a fresh perspective. That is, apply a different frame of reference. And here I just want to refer you to my favorite detective story. In Silver Blaze by Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes is able to solve the riddle of a mysterious murder by pointing out the exceptional behavior of the dog. So the puzzled police inspector, of course, says, "Well, the dog did nothing in the nighttime." And this, of course, exactly is what was so strange to Sherlock Holmes. The dog did not bark. In other words, the absence of something can be as significant as the presence. The police inspector, looking only for positive evidence, overlooks the dog's unusual behavior. As Sherlock Holmes puts it, "The inspector is a thorough man," he says to Watson, "but he lacks imagination." End of quote. Indeed, all of Haneke's films ask the viewer to do this type of detective work. And I include here his films for television that the Goethe Institute has shown in the US. And by the way, in the next 2 weeks, we will revisit the two-part Die Lemminge, Lemmings, here next Monday at 6:30, and the following Monday, it's part one and two. And here also Haneke asks really considerable powers of observation from the audience. Looking for clues in the closely observed daily rituals of Haneke's feature films, just look at, for example, here The Seventh Continent, or Benny and Benny's Video, or The Student in 71 Fragments of a Chronology of Chance, 71 Fragmente einer Chronologie des Zufalls, the German title, from 1994. None of these observations will help us to explain why those murders were committed. Only a careful and imaginative search for absences can help us to unravel the mystery. So here we have to look at absences. Right? If you look at that screenshot here, Breakfast in Seventh Continent, I will see how tightly framed it is around the hands of the family that will find a gruesome end. again, if you look just for clues, for positive values, we don't find them. We have to look for the absences. So let us then look into the many mysteries at the heart of the white ribbon, these many mysteries that find their expression in the three frames that I have mentioned before. The viewer, of course, you will initially wonder, who committed the crimes? Is this a new turn for Haneke, and, well, what is this all about? So at the very beginning of the White Ribbon, a German children's tale, Eine deutsche Kindergeschichte, that's the full title, over a black screen, a voiceover sounding like a frail old man assures us that he has, quote, to tell the strange events that happen in our village because they might shed light onto some occurrences in this country. So this is the very beginning of the film. Still, you have a black frame, and this voiceover comes in. It's the voice of a frail old man. So if this frail voice belongs to the teacher, and we only learn, we have to really think about who is this man talking, exactly 15 minutes into the film, we find out that it's the teacher we hear. We wonder for the first 15 minutes, who is this? Then we hear, oh, he describes something on the screen that concerns him. So, this must be the teacher, 15 minutes into the film. So if this belongs to the teacher as an old man, he looks like he's about late 20s, early 30s, and the story takes place at the eve of World War I, something that you, if you watch the film and you have not read the critics, you will find out the very, very end of the more than two-hour film. Then you have to think, okay, he must have survived both World Wars. So looking from this angle, the film then would seem to provide an explanation for the rise of fascism in Germany. How else could we interpret the words I quoted above, some occurrences in this country? White Ribbon is set in 1913, concentrating on the generation that came to age during World War I, experienced the troubles of the Weimar Republic, and then supported Hitler. In a European context, this frame of reference will be seen as an explanation of the rise of fascism. And the reviews generally stress this point. German and American reviews generally understand the film this way. However, and this is, I think, really the extraordinary thing about Haneke, any story, and he knows that, film, historical novel, that is set in the past, especially a past that takes place at the eve of an important historical moment, will be read as a comment on those events since it invites the recipient's historical hindsight. In other words, such a text will invite the relativism of the omniscient perspective of the later generation. The White Ribbon, set in the year preceding World War I, is actually Haneke's first period picture for the big screen. He's made two period pictures for television, but it's the first one for the big screen. So here, at least, it appears to be a return to a project that he had apparently planned for a long time, and is also a return, of course, to German language film. As you know, the film before was Funny Games US, the remake of his own Funny Games 10 years later for the American market, and also returned to several topics from that period. And in an interview, Haneke stated that he planned this initially as a three-part TV film and then later made it into this film here. And I would say in the light of Haneke's other feature films, The White Ribbon appears certainly strangely conventional, if you look at it, insofar as it provides a romantic subplot, something that you will not find in any other Haneke film, as well as characters with more psychological depth than other Haneke films. If you look at even Caché, even Code Unknown, Code Inconnu, you don't get any insight into the psychology of the characters. Here, in this film, you get a pretty good idea how the school teacher thinks and, for example, how the pastor thinks. So, crisp black and white photography with a deep focus, which is modeled after period pictures. It was actually filmed in color and the color was then digitally removed after the fact. Honecker said that you can find the right look, but you will never find the right color. But of course, I think his aim was primarily that look of old photographs. It has a deep focus, and you have these wide shots required sometimes. The cast, by the way, was also painstakingly chosen for the authentic look. Apparently, the casting was also very tedious, and he had to go to Romania, I read somewhere, to find farmers that actually look like farmers, like people who spend all of their life outside. But we also have we also have Steadicam shots that closely follow the character and frames their faces or their heads. So sometimes you have the camera running alongside the character very closely, very, very closely. So it appears almost as if the character is standing still and the world is moving behind them. So it's a strange contrast to those long, long wide shots of the landscape that you might remember. Indeed, as you know, the grown-ups are only known by their profession, the doctor, the pastor. Only the children have first names, and I think this makes these older people more, I would say, allegorical. They're actually allegories. It's the doctor, the pastor, the baron. So we have here the beginning, of course. Don't want to bore you with the plot if you've seen the film. I don't want to give away any ending. But right at the beginning, the doctor is, of course, hurt when his horse is tripped by a hidden wire. He's to be transported to the next town. And in his absence, the village's midwife, it's a woman in her 40s, as the script tells us, unmarried. Her son has Down syndrome. And she takes also care of the doctor's two children, 14-year-old Anna and 4-year-old Rudolf. The narrator here draws our attention to Clara, who's an uncannily precocious 14-year-old, the oldest daughter of the pastor, stern man who rules over his flock and his numerous children with a subtle mix of psychological pressure and brutal punishment. And the film's title, by the way, is derived from the white ribbon that the pastor's two older children, Clara and Martin, have to wear on their sleeves as a reminder of purity and chastity. And this village, isolated as it is, appears very much like a prison. And the violent events that puzzle the villagers are indeed actually no mystery for the viewer who, in spite of some red herrings, quickly figures out that probably the children vent their frustration in acts of violence. The larger mysteries, however, stay unsolved. The sudden disappearance of the doctor, the midwife, and their respective children is overshadowed by the outbreak of World War I. More important, though, is the narrator's puzzling promise of clarity regarding National Socialism, some occurrences that the film does not fulfill. So let us then look closely at the absences, as I said before, what's not there. This society exists as a strange hybrid of feudalism and capitalism. The village produces wheat for the landowner and is actually cut off from the outside. The next village, as you remember, if you've seen the film, is quite far away. Poor school teacher always has to struggle to find transportation to his fiancé. Strict faith. But there's nothing specific to Germany. And this is really interesting. I have here the script with me, and in stages of the script, there's still reference to Germany, fatherland, all these things. You will not find in the film any mentioning of Germany. Germany, nationalism is not mentioned. This is really interesting. He really took that out of the script. So no reference to Germany or the German nation is ever made in the film. And the film could be remade into White Ribbon US or White Ribbon France without much change. If you just dub this film and set it in I don't know, what's the wheat belt here in the States? Ohio? Kansas would be a great Kansas, right? A Protestant, strong, faithful Protestant community. This film could be set in Kansas in 1913 without any problems at all. And that, I think, is really fascinating because, of course, Haneke here poses the German question, the how could it happen, only to show that there is no German exception. Right? That's really exceptional. There is no German exception for Haneke. There's nothing here that we say, oh, right, these people had to become fascists. This is, so to say, the breeding ground for Adolf Hitler. There are no structures to be found here that would be called proto-fascist. There's no anti-Semitism, no nationalism, no militarism. Indeed, I think the question that the White Ribbon poses appears to be, how could it not happen? Right? This is, I think, really, again, a question of presence and absence. We know what happened, but here we will look in vain for positive clues that explains to us. So, because there's nothing that is exceptional about this community and nothing that could explain the later process of German history, the White Ribbon can only be understood as an examination of political power as it appears in everyday situations. And the French philosopher Michel Foucault has called this biopower. It's a concept that Foucault famously coined, and this, as I said, concerns not traditional power. Instead of the top-down structure of traditional power, biopower is more diffuse, a power of subtle manipulation and regulation. The objection might be made, of course, that the pecking order here appears to be so well established in this isolated village with a triumvirate of notables ruling over their flock, right, the doctor, the mayor, the baron, etc. However, everybody seems to be under surveillance and under a constant threat of punishment in the form of some form of imprisonment. No relationship, be it class, gender, or filial, seems to be exempt. Even the baron, on whom everybody depends in this isolated community, cannot prevent his wife leaving him for another man. For the most part, the film consists, therefore, of short fragments of interpersonal encounters and exchanges that introduce the main characters and map the power structures. Power, of course, the top-down power, is foremost patriarchal, and the slap in the face, it's its expression. If you remember, there's a very Haneke moment. In most of his films, there's a scene where somebody gets slapped in the face. It's often children. Eva in The Seventh Continent. Here, of course, it is several occasions to slap in the face. But still, violence or biopower also appears in the related form of the psychological pressure that the pastor skillfully exerts. So here I would say the related topics of interrogation and punishment structure the film's story, as well as the mise-en-scène. Those in power demand the truth, and I say this in huge quotation marks, the truth from their subjects. But instead of the mise-en-scène of a traditional film, Haneke finds an interesting expression for this type of relationship. Often, one character is seen from behind, blocking the left half of the screen with only the other party in focus. It should be noted that there is no symbolic element in this distribution. So there's nothing symbolic. For example, when the baron snaps at the hapless tutor, the latter is blocking the view, looking down on the baron who's standing on the lower landing. The deep focus photography of the film and the spatial arrangement make the baron appear small and distorted, even though he clearly wields the power as employer and father. Interesting enough, when the school teacher, if you remember the scene, I will show it later, was not a very skillful interrogator, he does not receive the shot. When he asks the school children what happened, he doesn't get this type of power shot. And as you know, he doesn't get anywhere. He doesn't find anything, and at the end of the film, he's as clueless as we are. So, again, we should see this in Haneke's oeuvre, and this is a shot here from the Seventh Continent. Here, Efi, the young girl who will be murdered by her own parents in this suicidal potluck at the end of the Seventh Continent, we have here a close-up. And this, I think, is a very Hanekian shot, this close-up that shows us the face. And I think you get here a very abstract quality. I would call it an effective power. It's none of this Hollywood acting where you read, so to say, an emotion into this girl's face, right? She's scared. Look at the same shot when we come to, again, return to the white ribbon. The little boy does not much emote here, but his face is really powerful. We just see his face here in his effective power. And again, when I say abstract quality, I mean this as a sign of the milieu. And with milieu, again, a French concept with milieu, I mean the whole socio-cultural makeup of the situation, right? He has the father, the pastor, he wields the power. He has not only the fatherly power, he speaks with the power of God, if you want. The same goes in Efi's face when the teacher asks her, why are you blind, what happened? Or later when the mother asks her, why did you do that in school? This is not about the little girl alone, it's about the whole situation again. Here I take the French word, a milieu. And I think this, what he expresses in these effective images, I think, is the biopower of that specific milieu, right? In school, if you remember school days, right, you are at the mercy of the teacher, right? He has or she has the power to ask you questions, right? What did you do, right? Did you cheat on your math test? That's a teacherly question, wants the truth out of you. And of course, it is clear that you're guilty right from the beginning of this interrogation. And that, I think, is really wonderful in Haneke's films. And you find this in all of his films, Code Unknown, all these other films, you find this scene of interrogations. And on the other hand, I would say, seen from the right perspective, these incidents and coincidences are truly funny in a farcical way. The interrogation of Martin, pastor's son, by his father, I think is more a performance of a farce, as the outcome of this attempt to bring out the truth of the matter is already clear from the start. The father already knows what's going on. But it's almost funny to see the father, a brilliant rhetorician, how he avoids calling the event by its proper name. And the consequences are of equally brilliant simplicity. When Martin goes to bed, he has his hands tied to the frame of the bed, right? I mean, just the ingenious, evil idea to just tie his hands on the bed. This is brilliant simplicity. This is almost, I would say, almost funny. In a very bizarre, macabre way funny. And I think this is kind of a bafflement when you realize that. It's almost funny, as I said, at least as comical, for example, and especially inspired bricolage. It's like a quick fix with the aid of mismatched and inappropriate materials. I mean, for the sake of the argument, I could construct a possible objective truth, exactly, of course, what Haneke avoids. Martin, like all 14-year-old boys, really masturbates. Or Martin, subject to religious indoctrinations from early childhood on, constantly fights the temptation to masturbate. This could both be very much possible. But his father's move is, as he puts it, to spare the confession, and then to spare Martin the temptation by tying down his hands. The truth, with a capital T, then, is not the irrefutable proof of stained bed sheets, if you want, or a real admission of guilt. He said, yes, I did it. Or even a shot in the film, this would be an obscene shot, of course, you will never find in Haneke, a shot that actually shows Martin masturbating in bed. You'll never find it in Haneke. but the truth that amounts to nothing more or less than the knowledge that is externalized in the Father's power. Right? It is a really bizarre thing. This kid, 14-year-old Martin, is already guilty. This is clear from the milieu, from the set out of this scene. And his father acts, and he's actually nice. Oh, I spare you the confession. Really interesting. The scene of that confession is connected by a hard cut to an equally funny, quote-unquote funny scene that follows this interrogation, where the truth is now as bluntly formulated as it was skillfully obscured in the scene before. The scene opens immediately with the orgasm of the doctor, who has just mounted the midwife from behind, both fully clothed, if you remember that scene. The midwife then formulates an objectively true statement. She says, "You did not miss me." And, after his puzzled inquiry, adds, "I say that because it is the truth." Their relationship is one defined by the objective truth. In a later scene, after an unsuccessful attempt by the midwife to pleasure her lover, he tells her, "To tell the truth, you repulse me." The two then proceed to objectively formulate the truth. I mean, brutally. He molests his daughter. She smells bad, etc. It goes on for a long time, culminating in the doctor's statement of his true feelings for her at that very moment. "By God, why don't you just die?" Here, I think the too open truth, right? You can only be too open about the truth, hides the true perspective of that the film allows us to see. The doctor and the midwife's relationship is driven by their respective self-hatred. This, I think, is really the point about these absences. Positively, you would wonder, why could anybody stay with such a person? But they need each other. They feed off of each other. And here, I think, is really an absence that we have to look into, what, so to say, at that dark hole here and the secret between those two people. Well, they need each other because they both hate each other. It's self-hatred. So I need to come now to the probable perpetrators of most of the acts of terror, the children. Children are perfect witnesses for Haneke. I would say the exception to the exception. This, I would say, goes for all of his films. Children are always the exception to the exception. We will see this next week in Lemminge. Think back to Effie in The Seventh Continent. Think back even to Benny in Benny's Video. If you remember the ending of Benny, he turns in his parents and formulates the truth, right? So, however, I think Haneke avoids the impression that children could be seen as essentially innocent, especially, I would say, in The White Ribbon. Clara, the pastor's oldest daughter, rams scissors down the throat of her father's beloved parakeet in order to punish him, if you remember that scene. That's the cover of the book, by the way. But I would say in all his films, the children are innocent of the violence to which they are subjected. So they are not the cute children you find in Hollywood films. Think about Kevin Home Alone, right? This cute little brat. Children are always innocent in American films. Well, these children are, so to say, the children of European auteur cinema. I think Rossellini, who, of course, was a major influence on Haneke. These are children that are not especially attractive. They are definitely guilty. Think about the little boy in Germany, Year Zero, by Rossellini, who kills his own father. But he's innocent of the situation. You certainly find this in even Funny Games. Right? The young boy who gets brutally murdered is not especially a nice kid. He's probably spoiled. It's a rich family. We don't like him for that, but he's innocent of the situation he's in. I find this here, certainly in this film. And interesting enough, if you remember the scene of the steward's son, he could get away unscathed for something terribly he did. He almost killed the Baron's son, or at least he threw him into the water. he wants to be punished. So he really provokes his father to carry out an especially violent beating. He really asks for it. Fascinating scene. So I would say that this society's ideology is aptly conveyed by an image that the Baron evokes in his plea to the populace to help him fight the elements that threaten the peace of the community, the very paragon of community that could live happily ever after were it not for the outside element that threatens it. Here we have to really closely observe these lines, and I only ask you to revisit the film. It's still in the playing, right, and it's out, will be out on DVD very soon. You can already download it, by the way, from Germany. So here, look at this film again. You will find in the Baron's plea a really interesting take here on the German exception, fascism. Because what the film then shows in its portrayal of the apparently cyclical and harmonic life is the material existence of the village's ideology that manifests itself in the recurring practices and routines that effectively constitute the subjects of this community who inevitably misrecognize themselves as the cause and origin of the ideology. So here I borrow, of course, a concept from Althusser. Ideology is not something external, but is something that expresses itself in the daily routines and practices. So the interrogation here is, so to say, ideology at work. So the perverse logic of a recreation of such a community in the form of the shared experience of a Volksgemeinschaft, the pure people, becomes immediately apparent. So here we have that link to German fascism. This other that prevents us from being full does, of course, not exist, right? There is no enemy. This community is already, if you want, pure. So it cannot be appropriated by identification. So here the pure people, the idea, again, of a Volksgemeinschaft, exists in spectral form only. And this, of course, means that we here have the projection, again, it's all about projection, of a very inhuman logic. So there we have, I think, historically, this kind of double hindsight, right? This community will be destroyed in World War I, and then in the failed attempt to recreate such a community that, as you can see here, witness here, if you want, is a very, very flawed community, the attempted recreation by the fascists will result in National Socialism. So here you have basically a kind of a double wave of looking back, right? We look back into this past, pre-World War I, and then we know, of course, what happened in World War II, so we have this kind of twice look back, and if you look back the right way, we'll see how unexceptional it is, but also how much of it is a projection. Here we have interrogation. We have recreation of a people. And so I would say The White Ribbon is, read in this way, a very political film. Now, we come to the final frame. And another form of this ideology at work here. Remember that little allegory when the little boy comes and asks his father for permission to keep the little bird in his cage. And, of course, the father is now suddenly very nice. Yeah, of course, you know. But, again, this is not a nice father in this moment. This is the same expression of this milieu. He's still the same agent, if you want, of ideology in this cage. Because here this is, of course, if you remember the metaphor in the film, those who grow up in captivity, like the little parakeet, love it. So here, let me now come to a cursory assessment of Haneke's project. And I would say if we follow the concepts that Haneke creates in The White Ribbon, and actually all other films before that, it becomes clear that he is a physician of culture. As Nietzsche famously said, a physician of culture, he looks at what is sick, what is problematic in the society, where's the ailment? And he would, I would say, indeed say that we have lost our connection with the past. We have lost our connection with the past. And this is why I think my student had this brilliant insight saying something that, of course, he was 9, 10 years old at the point that he says, well, I was responsible for 9/11. Right? He made this connection, right, to his past. Right? It's really a fascinating idea to read culture not as something that's past, but something that's very present. Right? For us, this time, 1913, should be much more present than it unfortunately is right now. Yeah? Interesting thing. We could just compare this film, The White Ribbon, to other World War I films. I don't know if you're a film fanatic like I am, but there are a couple of World War I films that came out a few years ago. There's, of course, A Very Long Engagement. There's also a German-French co-production that I forgot. It is actually set as this famous occurrence of the first war Christmas. And you might have seen that one. There's recreates that scene where the soldiers call on their own armistice and dance in the trenches and so on. This is, I think, from Michael Haneke's point of view, bad history, right? It recreates an event and puts it safely back into a past. With the Haneke film, he brings it to us very closely. That's why I said in my first frame, we, the audience, we have to work on it. We have to really work hard on these films to see what's going on. So I would say that we definitely do not have a return to values. And the community that Haneke constructs here seems to exist, as I said before, in a curious bubble. It's isolated. The villagers live in a strange hybrid of late feudalism and capitalism. But again, I think here Haneke skillfully contrasts the universal history of the historic film with the perspectival truth that I try to outline here. We have to look at it at a certain angle to see the truth emerge. And again, here is little Gustav, who asks his father in this memorable scene whether he can nurse an injured bird back to health. And our perspective, the audience's, the viewer's perspective, is Gustav's. And we experience the love for the authority of those who, quote, grew up in captivity, end of quote. Right? If you remember this scene, you really want this little boy to keep the bird. Right? This is fascinating how how Haneke steers the audience's sympathy. We love this little boy, yeah? But of course, we fully take Gustav's perspective, and we anxiously await the pastor's verdict: yes or no, life or death. The fatherly figure: yes, of course, no problem. We are relieved, but of course, it's a trap, right? We fall in a way in the same trap like little Gustav here. Gustav will grow up to love captivity, if you want. That's the trick here. So, slowly coming to the end of the first part of my talk. I'll show a few clips in a second. So, to repeat, I would say Haneke's concepts, cinematic concepts here, clearly show that we have lost the present, and the image of the past has already disappeared. Hence, as I said, the idea that this looks has the appearance of an old photograph. The past will now assault us in the form of the future. Remember the conspiracy of Georges and Majid's sons in Caché, or the conspiracy here of the children in The White Ribbon. This should be seen, I think, as a paradoxical return of the repressed future. So this is the paradox of Haneke. It is the future that haunts us, not the past. With Haneke, there's only a forward movement possible. And this movement means nothing less than the loss of cherished forms of identity. Here again, we come back to the German question, right? German identity. Remember maybe the impossible position of the camera in Caché. If you've seen the film, and if you own it on DVD, of course, like I do, and you will rewind and look for the hidden camera, it's not there. It's not there. There's a scene where you should see it. It's not there. So where is it? It's really impossible. And I think here, really, this should be seen as a take, I would say, on Walter Benjamin's Angel of History. And let me quote here Walter Benjamin's fifth thesis from the thesis on the philosophy of history. "For it is an irretrievable image of the past which threatens to disappear in any present that does not recognize itself as intended in that image." So here we ought to remember that the disappearance is not a passive or inconsequential one, but rather an event of violent proportions in its own right. This is where really the violence lies in Haneke's films. You know, his films have been called violent occasions, but I think the violence really is what it does to us, to our identity, if you want, to our image of the past. So if we want to step back for a sum or first kind of sum of my talk here, there is kind of a shift, if you want, or a movement in Haneke's films, all of them, and I think White Ribbon is one of his best films, maybe with Caché, which is my personal favorite film by him. One part, I think, is clear. The film shifts the major part of the process of making meaning onto the viewer, you, me, us, who is thus forced to perform a task that is normally done for the audience in mainstream cinema, that is, providing connections and explanations. If you've seen Avatar or the Transformers 2, which is the two big blockbusters of the last years, I don't know if you paid extra to see the film in 3D, Avatar, did you see it? Everything is explained several times. No? Everything is clear. That, of course, these films do not do. Then, I would say, on a metatextual level, on an outside level, the film forces us not only to reflect on these shifts and our involvement in the process, but indeed reflect on the process as what is represented. And here I would say really this is a move away from the content of the film. Right? Normally we consider a film by what kind of story is told. Avatar, very simple story. Transformers 2, very simple story. The content is there, we can retell the story. The form is basically, ooh, it's 3D. Or in the case of Michael Bay, ooh, it's super fast. And with a Haneke film, he tells us, no, this is not a separate process of representation. Form and content go into each other. If you present or represent the past a certain way, that's where the meaning lies. This is not a film about pre-World War I. This is a story about 2010. Right? This is a story about us now, because this is the image of the past. And I think it is this adjustment, right? We have to adjust to it. We're kind of shocked by it. That really will always be new in Haneke's films. This is what will be new in the next films that he will make. I don't see him. I hope he can quote me on that in a little while. I don't think he will change that. If you look at the entire oeuvre, you will see that he forces us, the viewer, to adjust our frame of reference permanently. Right? Think about it. What does that mean? What does it mean to us now, right? And instead of establishing the spectator as an all-seeing subject, here I think he's really reversing the much lampooned Hollywood rule of three. Have you heard about the Hollywood rule of three? And according to this rule, information vital to the plot has to be explained three times. Once for the smart person, once for the average viewer, and one's for the slow Joe in the back row. That's your official, unofficial policy. Here I would say, by restricting and limiting the spectatorial position, Haneke indeed forces the viewer to remember moments and even to actively rewind the film and look for clues. Thanks.
Dr. Oliver Speck spoke at the Goethe Institute in Washington, D.C. about Austrian film director Michael Haneke and his latest work, The White Ribbon. Mr. Speck's forthcoming book, Funny Frames, The Filmic Concepts of Michael Haneke, comes out June 1st. Special thanks to the Goethe Institute Washington and Tomasz Marek for this recording.